Okay, we'll start. I'd first like to thank all the people who helped with Lama Sepa's project. And they started to look like Petra, so I knew they were up there. You know, and I think it was two full nights without much sleep. And he did two beautiful fire offerings. And I think finally helped clear out the... I think there's some really tough local spirits there. The first time we did a fire offering, the rain was so hard they sent it sideways until about 2 or 3 in the morning. And so I think it went very well. And Lama Sepa sent a very beautiful letter thanking all the students who helped and saying that he had dedicated the fire offerings to the success of all our work here and to the success of everyone studying here. And that was the main prayer he'd had while he was doing 2 days of fire offerings there. So thank you very much for helping with that. And he was really pleased. He was really happy, which is a big good karma. And Rinpoche's teachings were unbelievable. So this 80-year-old man is teaching, and everyone in the room is tortured because he's gone on for like 5 hours. And he's still going, you know. And everyone's like, oh. And it was amazing. Teaching. So try not to miss the next, I think there's 2 more at least, the next 2 Sundays if you have that initiation. Okay, just extraordinary, really extraordinary. Okay. If there's any homeless people for Thanksgiving, you can come up to, is that right or not? Come to Godstow, have Thanksgiving dinner with us if you want. You might have to, but let Ellie know, okay? We have to know how many turkeys to let go. so like that. Also, John Stilwell, who will be directing this institute for the next 3 years, will give a talk after the group breakout tonight about the next series of classes. And you'll get an announcement for the next series of classes tonight. And there's probably 100 other things, but we'll go on. Okay, we are starting off on the last formal ACI course that there was, which was 15, okay, and that was called What the Buddha Really Meant, okay, and in Tibetan that's called Tange. Say Tange.
Tange.
Tange. Tange is a very, very important subject, I think, in every religion, okay. I think it is maybe the most important question in almost any religion. And it's the question of when was the founder of the religion speaking literally and when were they speaking figuratively? See what I mean? Lord Buddha's, there's a famous quotation by Lord Buddha that says, kill your father, kill your mother. Are we to take that literally or figuratively? You see what I mean? And obviously you're meant to take it figuratively. It means if you are not able to practice well in the home atmosphere, then leave it and get yourself to a monastery or go to another place where you can study seriously. But that's, Tange is obviously important. You know, if you didn't have the study of Tange, then people would go around killing their parents, which is one of the 5 great bad deeds. Okay, so I think in every religion, Tange is really important. And the beauty, I think, of Buddhism as it's been passed down to us through our lineage is that it's a whole sub... okay, that was literal. It's a whole subject of study. Like, there are rules set forth, or there are guidelines on how to interpret the Buddha. Okay, when was the Buddha speaking literally? When did the Buddha mean what he said? And when did the Buddha not mean what he said? Who gets to decide? How do you decide? And it's extremely important in all kinds of, in every religion, because of corruption. You know, like the founder or the prophet's words can be taken any way that people want to take them to prove that it's okay to do what they want to do. You see what I mean? Benjamin Franklin was a printer. He used these lead rods to keep the type jammed together in the vices while they're printing newspapers, Poor Richard's Almanac and things like that. And he once decided to become vegetarian. He has an extraordinary life story. He kept a book, by the way. It's a very beautiful book of his personal virtues. And then he got on a ship to go to England, and off of Newfoundland they were, what do they call it? Becalmed, or something like that. No wind. And there wasn't anything to do. So people started fishing, you know, and they started pulling up these fish. And he's, you know, he was a glutton, basically, and he really liked to eat. And he's watching them pull up these fish, and then more and more fish are coming up, and they start making little fires on bricks on the deck and cooking the fish. And he's getting really hungry, and he really wants to eat them, but he decided he'd be vegetarian. Then he's watching them clean the fish, and they cut open the fish, and these little fish come out. So he said, what's logical then, you know? The big fish eat the little fish, so it's okay for me to eat the big fish. And he started eating, and he stuffed himself with fish. And then finally at the end, he realized that it was just his desire that made him break the rules of logic. You see what I mean? Or misuse them. He said it was like bending lead rules any way you wanted to, when you wanted to. And so there's this tendency for people to take the Dharma and bend it to their own personal desires. You know what I mean? And your personal mental afflictions that you came to Buddhism with, you bend and twist the rules of Buddhism so that it fits what you want to do. You see what I mean? And pretty much, you often see people 3 years after their conversion to Tibetan Buddhism doing the same thing they did before, but now they have proof of why it's okay. You know what I mean? And that's why you have to study Tange. Okay, Tange is really important for deciding what did the Buddha really mean in each case. Okay, we study this subject in the monastery. We do the classical course is 12 years of perfection of wisdom, and then following that is 4 years of Madhyamika, middle way. And in between there, we study Tange for maybe 6 months to a year. Okay, and it's a really beautiful thing. We study the text by Jeton Kapa. It's called Lekshe Nyingbo. And Jeton Kapa's dates, you know, right? 13, 7, 57, and 14. Am I right? Yeah. Lekshe means eloquence, well-spoken. Often it means morally well-spoken, but we'll call it eloquence. Nyingbo means essence, the essence of eloquence. Okay. And in this book, Jeton Kapa, the first half is basically devoted to the ideas of the mind-only school on emptiness. And then the second half of the book is devoted to the ideas of the middle way school on emptiness. So basically, he's presenting a punch-out, a big fight between the mind-only school and the two halves of the middle way school on the subject of, guess what? What the Buddha meant when he talked about what subject, though? Emptiness. Okay? So it's really cool. The whole book is, you know, the Buddha taught emptiness basically six different ways. Five of them are wrong. Okay? So why did Lord Buddha teach it five ways wrong and then finally get to the right way? And who's to say which is the right way? Okay? How do you know what's the right way? Okay? For example, when he taught the mind-only version of emptiness, he taught it and then he criticized the middle way version of emptiness, taught by whom? Himself. Okay. And he said, this time I'm really telling the truth. Okay. I was wrong when I taught emptiness the middle way, you know. Now I'll tell you the truth. I was just kidding. You know, that's a nihilistic way to look at things. That kind of emptiness is too freaky. It's not like that at all. It's much, much less than that. It's much, much easier than that. And he taught it in a much mellower form, okay? Actually, as you know, the ultimate version is middle way, which is also accepted by tantric schools, okay? It's the whole basis for tantra. It is the highest way. But when Lord Buddha taught the mind-only school, he not only taught it differently, but in the middle of his explanation, he said, oh, and by the way, that thing I said in the middle way school was wrong, and I didn't mean it, okay? Later, he said the opposite. He said, I did mean it when I taught it that way. Okay? What's that tell you about how to interpret Lord Buddha? What's that tell you about the rules for interpreting Lord Buddha? Can you take his own statements on interpretation to be literal? Now, no. And that's a problem. You see, then it gets very difficult. Okay, get this. When Lord Buddha discusses how to judge whether he was being serious or not, you can't take him seriously. How's that? You see what I mean? When Lord Buddha set forth his opinion on what he wanted us to take literally and figuratively, he was being figurative. He didn't even mean that. Okay? So Jethro Kapa in the opening lines of his book is like, we have a problem here. You see what I mean? We're trying to decide what the Buddha said that he really meant and what the Buddha said that he didn't really mean. But when he said what he really meant, when he told us how to decide what he really meant and what he didn't really mean, he wasn't really meaning it. Okay? So now what do? You see, I mean, he says you're stuck. You see, you can't even trust it when the Buddha said, that's what I really meant, and I was kidding all the other times. Because he said that in the third turning of the wheel when he was teaching mind-only school. Okay? So now everything's out the window. So Jethro Kapa, I mean, this is the most beautiful and important part of this teaching, this final teaching, okay, which is today and next Tuesday, I think. Okay? The conclusion that Jethro Kapa draws in the first few pages is very earth-shaking. He says, you can't even trust the word of the Buddha when the Buddha is saying, that's what I really meant. Okay? Because he didn't really mean it. Okay? So guess what you have to trust? Your own reasoning. Okay? Your own reasoning. This is very profound. This is something amazing. What you have is the most important Tibetan Buddhist who ever lived is saying, you don't accept the Buddha's words, you accept what's logical to you that the Buddha said. Basically, that's what he's saying. You don't accept what the Buddha said unless it makes sense to you. That's a very earth-shaking. What makes sense to a normal samsaric suffering being is more valid than what an enlightened being says he really means. This is getting very heavy. Get it? Us little schmucks, what we think makes sense is more important and has more validity than what the Buddha said. Okay? And especially even when the Buddha said, that's what I meant, really. Okay? And the Buddha himself is adamant about this point. And I'm going to give you those. This is called the three tests of a Dharma. Okay? Lord Buddha is saying, I'm going to give you three tests for Dharma to check whether a teaching is true or not. And if anything I ever say doesn't fit that, reject it. Okay? And that's one of the most attractive things to me about Buddhism, is that the founder of Buddhism gets up in front of all the Buddhists of the world and says, you can't believe everything I say. You have to check it. And if you can't confirm it, and if you can't find that it's logical according to these three tests, including your own experience, then don't accept it. Don't do it. I think everybody who's in this room now is here because they did that to the religion they were in before. You see, I mean, each person who's sitting here applied certain tests of personal experience and logic to whatever beliefs they grew up with, and you're here because you questioned them. You see what I mean? And so in a way, you're already Chang'e scholars. You're already practitioners of Chang'e. You're here because you applied certain tests of logic or common sense or what makes sense to the beliefs that you grew up with, and you said, no, it's not enough, and that's why you're here. You see what I mean? You found some fault with them. You didn't just take the authority of someone who said, oh, it's like that. You mean? So these are called the three tests. Buddha said, if a scripture or a teaching or a worldview or an opinion in the world doesn't fit these three tests, then reject it. Even if I said it. Okay? Here they are. Say, Chepasun. Chepasun. Lord Buddha said, if you find a piece of... Somebody's trying to sell you a piece of metal as gold. You know, you grew up in America or some country like that, and they have all these standards. But in ancient India and the whole rest of history, someone came up to you with a yellow hunk of something and said it's gold, it's a problem. You see what I mean? You've got to test it, you have to check it. You know, there is no standard. There is no king. There is no, Institute of National Standards or something. Somebody is offering to trade your cornfield for this little piece of metal, yellow metal, and you have to figure out whether it's gold or not. I mean, in the old days, this was something important. You could trade your whole assets, your whole estate for these hunks of yellow metal. They could turn out to be useless. You see, I mean, everybody has to know how to check gold in ancient times. This is important, right? So he says, you check gold with three tests. You know, you cut it, you check it out, you see if there's lead on the inside. You melt it to see if it works right. And you use a certain kind of file. In the gold business, we still do that. There's a special file, and it tells you what the caratage is. You know, what percentage of it is gold, what percentage of it is alloy. And we still do it that way. Or we use certain acids and things like that. But he said, use three tests on what I teach you. And if it doesn't pass it, reject it. Don't follow it. Okay? Here's the first one. Buddha gets up and gives a teaching, and the first test you have to use is, does it match my personal experience? Now, for me, people ask me why you became a Buddhist. One of the first events that made me a Buddhist was suffering. You know, death of my mother, death of my father, death of my brother in 1 year, you know. And then I come across this really bad translation of a sutra, but it's clear that this guy is talking about suffering and saying that if the world is really like this, if every event in the world is connected to your eventual dying and losing everything you have and losing every possession and every friend and every relative you ever had, if that's the manifest destiny of all mankind at all times, in all histories, in all countries, of all economic levels, then what's it mean to be alive? You know, what's the point of being alive? You know, if you can't do something about that, then what's the point to stay here? If something got rather difficult, you should just shoot yourself. You see what I mean? Why try to be here if it's obvious from the beginning that nothing you ever worked for will survive, you know, including yourself, okay? So that was the first, for me, that matched my personal experience of that year so well that I was very attracted to Buddhism. You see what I mean? So it passed my first test. You see what I mean? I was having trouble with those questions. They were not answered in my old belief system. It didn't make sense why people should die or suffer if there were somebody who made them and who was compassionate and who didn't have to make them with cancer. It just didn't make sense. It didn't pass. But this one, that fits what I'm experiencing personally. That fits what I'm seeing happening in my own life. Okay, that's the first test. Okay. Number two. Does it make sense means, does it fit my logical perceptions? Okay? These are direct perceptions. Okay? Some things you can't see with your eyes, but you can figure them out. Now, the things that I figured out that way, does what Lord Buddha taught make sense? Like, I haven't seen my death in this lifetime yet. I haven't perceived the loss of all my possessions and things like that. But based on deduction of what's happened to everybody else I ever heard of in this desire realm, it's going to be pretty bad. You know what I mean? So yeah, Lord Buddha says, you yourself are going to die. You yourself are going to lose all your possessions. Can I see that directly right now? No. But does it make sense given the New York Times obituaries and all that? I mean, it makes sense. Every person I've ever heard of, every person I've ever met, every person I've ever had contact with says the same thing. Everybody who comes into this life has to die. Everybody who comes into this life has to lose everything. So based on deduction, I know that's true. I haven't seen my own death directly now, because I haven't died yet, okay? And I don't have the ability to see the future for that right now. So does it make sense that I probably am going to die? For example, when you do a death meditation, does it make sense to do that? And you say, yeah, it does. Oh, why? Because you died yesterday? No, but logically I know it's going to happen. Okay, that's all. It fits my, not only my direct experience, but it makes sense logically. What I understand with my own sense of reason, Lord Buddha, what Lord Buddha said makes sense. Okay, even on the things I don't quite understand yet, like emptiness or something like that. Even on those things, what I do understand makes sense. Okay, number three. Is it authoritative, meaning credible? This is a third test, okay? And this test goes like this. A person gets up and says something that you're not sure about, okay? But you've known that person long enough that you believe them. You see what I mean? You've tested the person so exhaustively that on the subject of something that you cannot perceive directly, you believe them because you believe the source, okay? You know, there's certain people in your life that if they come and tell you, I heard this is going to happen tomorrow, you say, yeah, okay. You know, and then there's other people who never say anything that's BS. You know what I mean? Everything they ever told you in your life was true. And then they tell you something very important, and, you know, you can't check it out yourself. But because they've spoken to you truly your whole life, and because you believe in them, then you take it. You know, that's the third test. It passed the test of credibility. It's coming from a person who's credible, okay? So even though I may not be able to check it out with my own personal eyes, which would be the first test, and even though I can't figure it out logically, which would be the second test, this person, this particular person, I've had many, many exchanges with them. I've talked to them countless times. They've told me countless things. Every single time it was true. Now they said something incredible. I tend to want to take it, accept it. It passes my third test, okay? And that's the whole thing where you have to, in Buddhism, can you establish that the Buddha is credible? You see what I mean? Once you've figured out that this particular scripture was definitely written by Lord Buddha, spoken by Lord Buddha, then you just have to decide, am I going to believe everything Lord Buddha said or not? Can I believe what Lord Buddha said or not? Is it important to check out or not? You see, I mean, how do you test if Lord Buddha is capable of lying or not? You know, like Tibetan Buddhists will tell you Lord Buddha is Sema. Sema means pramana. Pramana in this case means a person who cannot lie. Okay? They say Teme Kibu, a person who cannot lie. But how do you establish that? How do you establish that a person is a person who cannot lie? You know, one way is to study a lot of Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhist scripture until you're satisfied to the point where if I know this scripture was truly spoken by Lord Buddha, since every other one I ever read was believable, credible, then I will accept this one now and I'll act on it. Okay, that's one way to do it. But it's very interesting, in the scriptures, they say the main way to establish that Lord Buddha is a person who's credible, authoritative, is... This is really cool, and it sold me, okay? It was credible to me. It said, he's the only one who can describe your suffering correctly. You see what I mean? He's the only person you've ever run into who could describe to you honestly how bad you're suffering, how bad things are. You see what I mean? The first noble truth, the first thing Lord Buddha ever said, you know, everything, duce tanje dungyawa, everything is suffering, you know? And then, you know, other people will tell you 50% is suffering, 25% is suffering, 10% is suffering. But to come up and say everything is suffering, the face of a beautiful child is suffering, a beautiful sunset is suffering, a nice Mexican dinner is suffering, okay? To be healthy is suffering. To have a nice relationship is suffering. To have a good position and money and health is suffering. You know, come on. You know what I mean? But if this, and by the way, I don't think you've seen it anywhere else. You see what I mean? But if you have one person who has the chutzpah to stand up and say, everything is suffering. Everything in your life is pain. You know, everything is either pain or pain waiting to happen, period. You have to lose everything. Every good thing you can give me on a list of what's going right in your life will be destroyed in a year. You know what I mean? Period. And it's just the main method of establishing that Lord Buddha is a credible person is that he said that. Okay? And to me, when I think about it, that matches my personal experience in college. You know, I came across this Buddhist book and I'm like, this guy knows what he's talking about. Why? Because he can describe the problem at least, and nobody else I've ever met did. You see what I mean? And it was just, to me, it was just like, wow, you know? I said that the first thing was the death of my family. The second thing was my high school girlfriends, okay? Meaning, why is it that these relationships always turn sour? You know, why is it that the person that you're most attracted to turns out to be the one you'd most like to get away from? It's just a matter of time. You know what I mean? Why is it that there's always this curve like this, you know, with most personal relationships? It was driving me crazy, you know. And then Lord Buddha has a very simple answer. It's destroyed because it started. You know, it will end because it had a beginning. You know what I mean? And it's like profound, you know. Things go wrong because they started. Okay. And nothing else is necessary. They say, meaning, without any outer factors necessary at all, everything you live for will be destroyed. Okay? It doesn't take a car accident or an atomic bomb or AIDS or anything else to ruin your life. What ruins your life is your birth. You see what I mean? And this is just profound to me. You see, someone who can describe the conditions so perfectly, to me, that's a big step towards being a person that I can believe. Okay, so that's the third test. Those are the big three tests. I think you had a question. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. How can you consider the Buddha credible when he contradicts himself?
He said, how can you consider the Buddha credible when he contradicts himself? If a person could give compelling reasons why they must contradict themselves to help other people, I think you could consider them credible. You see what I mean? But he better give some good explanations why. You know what I mean? And that's all. Yeah. By the way, if you had to debate anything, tonight would be the night, because there's so many debates here. Did he mean it when he said this, for example? You know what I mean? Yeah. Oh, by the way, test it with the three to see. Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely hard. You have to go up to number two. That takes number two. Yeah, on things which are kokyur, meaning things which are for you hidden right now, it's important to go straight to number two.
So yeah. Then number two creates a form of number one?
Yeah, but it's important with number two, even though with something like emptiness you have to go straight to number two, it's still important to use number one to check if the way they explain it is contradicted by anything in your personal experience. You see what I mean? Even though you can't see emptiness directly, is there anything you can see which would discount emptiness as Lord Buddha explains it? You see what I mean? That might be something you can establish with your eyes, you know? And that's okay. What I'm saying is that you can use direct personal experience to come up with a no objection so far. You see? I can't confirm emptiness with my direct personal experience, but I can't disconfirm it either. I use this a lot about future lives. You know, I am one of the first American Buddhist teachers, right? So people are always asking me in our culture, prove future lives to me, you know? And then one day it just dawned on me, I said, you prove to me there aren't any future lives, you know? I'm tired of proving it, you know? You give me one shred of evidence that the mind doesn't go on when the body dies. Okay, 99% of the arguments against future lives are the body stops moving. I didn't debate that the body stopped. I agree the body stops. We're talking about the mind. Okay, so the driver dies because the truck breaks down. You see what I mean? What is that kind of sense is that? What kind of argument is that? That's the only argument. The brainwaves stop. Okay, the physical manifestation of the mind has stopped. Does that mean the mind has stopped? You see what I mean? There's no proof at all. By the way, I'll take you backwards, okay? This is illegal logic. Your mind doesn't stop. Forget it. The mind does not stop. It just doesn't stop. Now work backwards. Try to give me one shred of proof that indicates that it does stop. It just doesn't. Okay? There is no proof. I mean, I'll tell you from the beginning, you can believe me if you have perception number 3 here. Okay? Those of you who I haven't robbed or cheated.